The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I think partly because I'm going to be gone for a while, I thought tonight would be a good opportunity for me not to give a talk, but to rather try to respond to your questions, to hear what's on your mind and what concerns you have about your mindfulness practice, Buddhist practice, Buddhism, you know, whatever else it might seem related. So if you have any questions, this would be a good night. And then we have a mic. It might be nice to pass out the mic. And if you have something you'd like to ask.
Good evening. My name is Tanya. I live in Massachusetts. I've been practicing for about 2.5 years or so now. And I started counting my breaths, and I started count 1 to 10, and then 1 to 100, and then from 100 to 1 again. And I've been doing this different types of counting. I was counting or mantra. And finally, a Zen priest told me that I should stop counting at all and just to stay and be with my thoughts. And then it was all over again. I mean, my thoughts were all over again. So where do I go from here?
It's a nice question. Thank you. Counting the breath is often considered to be a form of concentration practice. So it helps settle the mind, focus the mind. It's a great way to cut through thinking and settle that thinking mind, and so you can be very present. And if you can go from 1 to 100 and back again, you're getting pretty concentrated. My guess is that you're feeling pretty centered, pretty calm by the time you've done that a few times. Yeah. So that's very nice. And that becomes a foundation then to be able to do a different kind of practice, which is not concentration, because not much of your life happens in counting breath from 1 to 100. So there's not much wisdom there, even though it has some benefits. And probably the Zen priest did not tell you just be with your thoughts. Probably it somehow was miscommunicated one way or the other. But probably what they said was just to be with what is. And that's a tricky thing to hear, because it can be heard. Just allow things to be whatever way they are. And so if you're thinking, just think away. Think with abandon. And then you're back at where you started, with the monkey mind taking you off and not being present much. But rather what you want to do is, when you have that stability, the mind is settled enough, like you now have the ability to do through counting, is when you stop counting, what you want to do is to develop do a couple of things, at least in our tradition here. We're not teaching Zen here, but you want to pay careful attention to what is happening, without being caught by what's happening. And so, if there's thinking, you want to clearly be aware, oh, there's thinking, without being involved in the thinking. And we make a distinction between thoughting and thinking. And the mind on its own will produce thoughts. It's our involvement with them which creates a chain of associated thinking. And so if you're really just very present and see the thought arise in the mind, it won't go anywhere. But if you're not so present, then what happens, usually we get involved. If emotions arise, then the same thing, we're there for that, to see it clearly, to note it, be aware of it. But we're not entangled with the emotion. We're not being for it, we're not being against it, we're not struggling with it, we're not making something, just allowing it to be there. And then the same thing, that emotions over time, they continue over time because we're involved in them. If we're not involved in them, but instead are very present, then they begin to shift and change in some way they're going to do. Many times in meditation, they tend to settle. The more difficult ones settle, and things like joy tend to become stronger, or peace becomes stronger. But the trick is not to be involved in them in any kind of way, just to be very present. If strong sensations in your body arise, the same thing, then to be present for that, just to feel and sense it and be there. Again, not being for, again, not to be involved. So the trick is to have this very strong capacity for mindfulness, awareness, that allows you just, some places, especially in Zen, they sometimes talk about just being, just to be with what is. But just to be is different than being caught up in what is. So that's the shift, just to be with be. And the way we support that in this practice here is we add to that being, just being with what is, a clear knowing of what is. So it's not just to be present for thinking arise, or feeling arise, or sensation in the body arise. There's a very clear, I'm not entangled, I just know it. But I know it clearly. There's a clear seeing of it, or a clear kind of looking more carefully, what is this experience? And that allows us to go deeper and deeper. And then with time, in the practice we teach here, the mindfulness shifts to insight. We start seeing really deeply what's going on here. Now, is that clear, or does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does.
Does it seem like it's something that makes sense given your practice?
Yes, definitely. Yes? Thank you.
So I have... I'm sorry, did I go
please,
out of turn?
Please go ahead.
Okay. I have a question related to what she was saying. And you know, I've been meditating for about 3-4 years, and there are certain reoccurring thoughts and emotions. And so when I inquire, you know, what is this? How am I feeling? What's going on? It has a tendency to draw me in as I'm inquiring. And certainly there is a detachment because I'm asking myself questions, but there is this draw of intensity.
Right.
And I was wondering if you could speak
to
that.
Great, good question. I think for people who have a strong habit to think, mindfulness sometimes can get confused with thinking. We want to bring mindfulness to something, and we get pulled into the world of thinking about it. And inquiry, you know, especially if you start inquiring more deeply, what is this? So first of all, mindfulness by itself is a clear recognition of what is, without any further inquiry. So if you're thinking, it's established a very clear awareness. Oh, here is thinking, and just let it be that. Just nothing else happens. As you do that, you start noticing all the other things that do happen. So you start teasing apart, oh, look, I'm practicing just being with the thinking, but there's a lot of interest in the thinking. So let's feel and sense what interest is like. Let's be present for the interest. Or as you try to be with the thinking, you see that there is a judgment about the thinking. Oh, let's... Now I can need to be present and see the judgment. So just being present for something and seeing it sometimes flushes out the relationship we have with it or the bigger picture of what's going on. But your inquiry is not that simple. Your inquiry is trying to do something. Maybe trying to stop that kind of thinking, I suspect. Is that right?
Well, you know, I can label the thinking, and the thinking will actually drop away.
Right.
But it's the emotion, and it's the inquiry about the emotion.
So what's your intention in doing the inquiry? What are you hoping to do with the inquiry?
To know it well.
To know it well. And why is it not enough just to know it simply?
Because I've... believe, and I've been told here, I believe, that when I know something very well, when I know it very, very well, that I will be able to move through it, and it will drop away. And I can move to a different place.
Oh, yes, it will. But I didn't say when. the idea is to let things. Seriously, the idea is to be, in a sense, is to be simple with what is. And so you might need to spend a little bit of time with ideas that you bring along. And it is rather unfortunate that it's kind of inevitable that when someone like me teaches it, I also give people ideas. And so you have to also get free of the ideas your teacher teaches you. And so it's no way around it, I think. And just to learn what it's like, just to let things mean something be. Now, if something is there, like emotions, a really long time, then inquiry is an important part of this process. I don't want to say that inquiry is not part of it. But then you want to be very judicious about the inquiry, so it really starts off very, very simple. And when you sit down to do inquiry, to look a little bit more carefully at what this experience is, have a long-term view of the inquiry. Don't try to do it really fast or efficient. Like, you know, try to get to the bottom of this sitting. I'm going to get to the bottom of this. It's like, I think as I sit here for the next while, for the next sitting, maybe I can, what's the physical side of this? Let me today just really be aware of the physical side of this emotion and really get into that and really sense that. Some other time what is the intention that seems to be present with that emotion? So you're asking yourself very simple questions. There is a little bit of thinking involved in that, but you're not following it with analysis. It's more like, oh, let me turn my attention to this part of the experience, to the physical side, to the intentional side, to the cognitive side, to to a variety of different things, and be really simple with that side of it, from that perspective. And then see what unfolds when I'm present that way. Does that make sense? And maybe that'll help you so you don't get analytical and start thinking too much about it.
I'm actually very aware of not allowing myself to do that and just being present. Uh-huh. But especially with certain emotions, I'll ask myself, what is this like? And then I'll start describing it in my head in words instead of just physically experiencing it. Uh-huh. And that actually tends to draw me in more, into it.
So can you give me some kind of, it could be made up example.
For this meditation, I was thinking about how, how frustrated I was with coworkers and employees, and I felt almost like I was in the very turbulent water with waves crashing over me, and I was, so I started just experiencing that, those sensations.
That's good. Then you described it to yourself as turbulent seas.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So then, that's good. So you recognize that. So you need to be able to recognize when you're thinking more than sensing, more than being present, and when your thinking is abstract. And to describe it to yourself as turbulent seas, you're describing it as an abstraction, as an image, as a metaphor, or something. And so that, and it's different than saying, so if someone feels real tight and heavy in their shoulders, the direct experience is tight and heavy. If they're describing it to themselves as they have football shoulder pads on their shoulders or carrying a big backpack, for the purposes of mindfulness, that kind of image takes you away from the direct experience. So as you're being mindful and tracking what you do, you also then notice the simple descriptions you're giving yourself of the experience. Is it an image or is it direct? And you want to keep it really simple and really direct. Oh, there's a lot of energy. There's a lot of movement of sensations in my body right now. There's a lot of chaos in the thinking. And just keep it really simple. So you need to learn to differentiate the kind of descriptions you give yourself. And perhaps there's a way of making the descriptions simpler and simpler and simpler, but they keep you right on track as well.
Yeah, so that's actually very helpful, because what I find is that when I go into these visual metaphors, that it actually intensifies the emotion.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
And a lot of emotions, some emotions get reinforced by the stories we tell ourselves or the images that we bring into them. So that's what you're finding. In other situations in life, outside of meditation, sometimes it's interesting to explore the images that come up. Because images sometimes are relevant, or they're symbolic, or they speak to some other part of the psyche. So they might be interesting to explore the wave metaphor for you, some other situation. It might, you know, they say, you know, a picture's worth a thousand words. So there's a lot there in the image. But you don't want to do that kind of analysis when you're meditating, because then you're not meditating.
Do all Buddhists believe in the many lifetime idea?
No.
Is it something that is beneficial, or is, or just not one way or the other? Or
I think that if you ask, you know, survey a range of Buddhists, you'll find some that feel very strongly that they believe in rebirth, many lifetimes. Some who will say even more strongly, they'll say, you can't really be a good Buddhist or practice Buddhism without believing that. Buddhism doesn't make sense unless you believe in that. There are other Buddhists who say, I believe in rebirth, but it's not really necessary to believe it. You know, you know, it's not really that important. And you don't have to if you don't want. And there's other Buddhists who will say, they don't believe it. And you know, and it's not part of my practice at all. So you find the range, and then if you survey those Buddhists as well, you probably also ask them, is it beneficial to believe or not believe? And some will say, oh, it's very beneficial for me to believe it. It's helped me a lot in my practice. And you survey some of the people who say they don't believe it, and they say, oh, it's very beneficial not to believe it for me. Now. On what basis do we decide for other people? What basis would someone say to you, you know, it's beneficial for you to believe it, or it's beneficial for you to not to believe it? That's an interesting question. And perhaps one of the criteria would be for you is it helping you become free? What way is it helping you become free or a better person? Because some people get caught up in the beliefs of rebirth in such a way that it actually weighs them down. And some people get caught up in the idea that there is no rebirth, and that weighs them down. So how does this function? What's the impact it has on you?
So it's according to how it's useful in your own practice.
Well, that's one criteria, is how useful it is for your practice. And then you have to have some sense of what your practice is. You know what your practice is, so if the practice is liberation or freedom, is it helpful for you to be in becoming free? In what way is it helpful? So is that an adequate enough question for you?
Yeah, well, it seems that For what I get out of it is that if it's useful for your practice and makes it and like you say, if it helps liberation, and that's what you're shooting for, that's important. Thank you.
Yes.
I had an experience this morning, living in my apartment with a storm, and I'm on the bottom floor, and there's two carports on right angles, and I'm in the middle, and each carport has doors which are broken without hydraulic hinge. And so the wind slammed the door and startled me awake, I don't know, about 5:30. And my first thought was, in the past, I probably would have been really thinking some negative thoughts about the door and the landlord and why they're not. You know. And then I was so happy because I was astonished because, you know, like I was sound asleep, and the first thought was, always walk through every door. I couldn't couldn't believe it. This is what my thought was. And then my second thought was, it's all empty. You know, and I had this perfect picture of this door, you know, because I've been living there for 16 years, and the door opens into nothing, into the empty carport. And then the back, it just, there's nothing there. It's just the side of the building. And I just was so deep in me, you know, and it came out. I was just like really, really thrilled.
So for those of you who don't know, haven't noticed, the current IMC newsletter, which you can pick up on the way out, has a story in it about an abbot who gives the instruction, always walk through, completely through the doors, and it's all empty. It's in the story, so that's what she's referring to.
And so also I wanted to, because in that story, I guess I've been processing it subconsciously for a while. It's kind of like a Zen koan, and you know, in the story, it doesn't really say what they mean. So that might be, you know, it's working on my subconscious, you know, my sub. But I wanted to ask you if it does mean, I mean, this is what I think it means, and I don't know if you want to say or not what it means, but I think it means don't allow any resistance, any clinging or any aversion. When any of the sense doors come in contact, there's certain words that they talk about, the taste, mm-hmm. the smell, or they call it eye consciousness, ear consciousness, but just to experience it mindfully and completely without resistance or clinging to it. And let it pass through. I don't know if that's correct, but that's right.
It's a beautiful interpretation. Thank you. Speaks very, very well for our practice. There was a Burmese, very famous Burmese meditation teacher named Mahasi Sayadaw, and he was kind of he died around 1981, and he kind of was one who started the whole movement of Vipassana meditation that we're part of. IMS is part of, and Spirit Rock kind of formulated this particular way. And he had this reputation that if you went to see him, people like to describe him this way. It's like, as I said, it was like, when you went to see him, it was like going to a house where all the doors and windows were open and the lights were on, but no one was home. Now, some people hear that description and they're inspired. And some people hear that description and get very discouraged. Anyway, I liked your interpretation. Thank you for it. Yes, Peter. Oh, does someone else have the mic? Please go ahead.
Okay. Hi, my name's Thomas, and recently I have a lot of like anger and agitation about my life situation. I recently lost my job because of company layoff, and then I found out a lot of my friends are not actually my friends. And my love life is not working well either. So it pretty much is like, that's one reason why I come to IMC is I really want to try meditation to really try to, I don't know, I don't have the right word for like, I don't want to say fix or somehow deal with my anger and agitation. But I just want to see if you have any insight about that, like what's the best issue to deal with life situation, which is not easily fixed, especially the job situation is so bad right now.
Great. Mm-hmm. Great question. Thank you. And it's a question that deserves looking at in many different ways, more than we can do here. And I'm thinking that, just for everyone to say, I was thinking that perhaps in when I get back, come back, maybe starting in mid-April or something, to give a series of talks that maybe we can call it tentatively on being emotional. And actually spend an evening on different emotions, like take an evening on anger, an evening on fear. The biggest thing that comes to my mind to say as I listen to you, what I hear is that some of the major issues of a person's life are being challenged. Work is a big issue, and so having work disappear, and you know, it's very difficult for a person. Friendships and social life challenged, very difficult, and intimate relationship, love life, not working out, it's also very challenging. And these areas of life is where we tend to, we often invest a lot of ourselves, and we also invest a lot of our beliefs about what life is about and what's important about it, and also a place we invest a lot of ideas about who I am, what I need, who I should be, how I need to be seen by others, how I need to be seen by myself. There's a lot that goes in there. When life doesn't work out the way we want it to work out, it's often a very important opportunity to turn the attention around and begin questioning and looking at the beliefs, ideas of self, values that went into the way we operated in those domains. So if everything had worked out perfectly for you, and you had your job just continued beautifully, great career, successful, lots of praise from everyone, all those people became even better friends. You know, wow, you know, you're great, you're the best. And the women or the men, I don't know what your thing is, but you know, we're all after you. Then, you know, or both, I don't know. you might never ever question the underlying beliefs and values and priorities that go into the life you're living. And it would be a poor life, even though you're getting all the things that you want. There are plenty of people I meet who have the rug pulled from underneath their life, and it's really hard for them. Lots of grief, despair, anger, lots of difficult things. And some years later they say, that was the best thing that ever happened to me, because it forced me to question the very foundations upon which my life was based. And I had to look at it in a whole different way. And so I would suggest for you, it's certainly reasonable enough or expected enough that in your kind of situation someone would be angry. And you could work with anger. There's all these teachings we have about anger. There's talks on Audio Dharma I've given about anger. You can listen to them. But rather than dealing with the anger, it might be more valuable for you to look behind this particular circumstance you find yourself in and see, take the opportunity to look at what is the values, what are the beliefs, what are the attachments, what is the sense of self, what's that really were at the foundation of your life that maybe don't really serve you so well. And maybe there's something new, a new way of being in the world.
This is very deep. Do you mind I can give an example? I kind of know what I'm talking about, but I'm really lost as well.
Okay. So I'll try to give an example. I'm afraid that if I give examples, maybe it'll be maybe a little bit simplistic. But for example, someone's whole orientation towards life is to make a lot of money. And so when they lose their job, it's very frustrating, very difficult. And their whole sense of identity, who they are, is they need to become someone who's seen by others as a wealthy person, you know, successful. And so their sense of self and their happiness is tied to financial success. When there might be better things to base one's life on than financial success. There might be more reliable forms of happiness and well-being than financial success. If the person's financially successful, they might never have a chance to question that. And lots of surveys have pointed out that wealthy people, wealthy societies, aren't necessarily more happy than people who are not wealthy. Sometimes actually less happy. So there's the advantage of not being financially successful could be for someone driven by financial success to question that and reassess and say, well, is there something else I want my life to be based on? Or it could be status. Or it could be power. Or it could be fear that's underlying it all. Some people are really afraid of catastrophe and problems, and so their whole life is oriented on fear. And when the very thing they're trying to build up and protect themselves from happens, then they have to turn around and look and question maybe the source of the fear. So, for example, there was one man in our community here who I knew him for many years, and he was always nervous. He was always kind of afraid. Kind of everyone around him, you kind of feel this, kind of nervous. And one of the things he was most afraid of was getting cancer and dying. At some point, he got cancer. And then at some point, he was dying from it. And what was remarkable was his fear went away. Because there's no reason to be afraid of it. that it was going to happen. It was happening. it was unfortunate he died, but there was such beauty and profundity in him in those last period of his life because something dropped away. So those examples meaningful for you or give you?
Yes, thank you.
Some people, their whole life is oriented around wanting people to see them in a certain way, their parents. I need to be successful for my parents' sake. And when they can't be successful for their parents' sakes, they get to question that. Is there another thing to base one's life on? This could be a really, really important opportunity for you to reassess your life in a really deep way. And the anger you feel is really, it's relevant. It's important, it's relevant. It's something, but it might go away. The anger might not be such a big deal if you realize what a phenomenal opportunity you've been given to question your life in a really deep way.
Thank you.